The following is a message from Pastor Ellis Orozco of First Baptist Richardson. For more information, please visit fbcr.org.
Jesus said, "You are the light," and so we are to shine that light for a world that so desperately needs it. We're in the last, actually, sermon of a series of sermons we've been doing on the art of neighboring, what it means to be a neighbor, and really attempting through this series of sermons to talk about reclaiming something that we seem to be losing in our culture and our society, and this ability to be a neighbor and to really know the people who are living all around us and the people who come into our sphere of influence in life. And so we've been talking about that for a while. This is the last sermon in that series. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 5 for this sermon, Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. We're going to be looking at that. But this last sermon in the series, and then next week we begin a new series called Dystopia. And we've been talking about this for a while. I know that many of you have seen the title of this series and have gone home to Google Dystopia, right, and figure out dictionary. It's actually, you can think of it as the opposite of utopia. And there are a number of films that have come out recently that are dealing with this particular issue. And so we wanted to kind of address some of the foundational issues to this idea of dystopia. And we're going to be taking four different movies. We're not preaching from the movies. We're preaching from the Bible, by the way. But we are going to be referencing four movies that have actually touched on this issue of dystopia: The Hunger Games, Maze Runner, The Giver, and what's the fourth one? Divergent. Yeah, that Divergent. Thank you. Yeah, y'all have already seen that, right? Divergent. Good. And I hope if you haven't seen those movies, you might want to look at them. But they really talk about this idea of anytime human beings attempt to build this utopian society on their own, if you look close enough, if you look behind the facade of utopia, you find pain and anger and brokenness. In other words, you find sin. It's this very biblical theological idea that anytime we try to build this perfect world, it never comes out perfect. In fact, many of these films deal with very much biblical theological ideas of the problem of evil and suffering and the problem of the sinfulness and the brokenness of mankind. And so we're going to be talking about some really big subjects in this series. I'm very much looking forward to it. And this is also a series that you want to invite your friends out there, because they're watching these films and they're wrestling with these same ideas of why can't we ever get it right? And so this sermon series is going to be talking about those kinds of things. But let's go back now to the current series, this last sermon on it, and Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. Let me read there. This is in the heart of Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is speaking, and he says to his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." May the Lord bless the reading of his word. The theme of Jesus' words here in Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16, basically is that we, as Christians, we as the church, cannot hide. The one thing that we cannot do, the one thing that we absolutely must not do, is to hide. Now, this is Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount. It's actually more of a teaching than it is a pure sermon, more of an essay almost than it is a sermon. Jesus has taken his closest disciples, and he has gone on this kind of mountainside retreat with them, and he sits them down, and he begins to teach them, to tell them, to give them his rabbinical halacha. The rabbi's halacha was the rabbi's way of life, their rule of order. Every rabbi in the first century had their own, and they would specific, particular way that they taught their disciples to live about their lives with God. And this is Jesus teaching his disciples his halacha, the Jesus way of doing things, and he wants them to learn it. Now, Hans Dieter Betz has written an exhaustive commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, 800 plus pages just on these three chapters out of Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And in his exhaustive commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, Betts has identified the genre of this section of Scripture as the Greek epitome. This famous, very well-known Greek essay form in the first century, where a writer, a thinker, a philosopher, a teacher would summarize all of his learning, all of his knowledge, all of his wisdom. He would summarize it into this kind of brief space. He would take everything that he has known and he would boil it down to this essay, this one. He would take the epitome. That's why it's called the Greek epitome. He would take the epitome of his teaching and put it into one succinct kind of teaching or essay. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing here in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. He is taking everything that he knows to be true, everything that he knows to be right, everything that he has heard from God, and he is boiling it all down into this one sermon, if you want to call it a sermon or essay, or this one teaching. And the verses that we read, Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16, those verses are the culmination of the introduction to the essay or to the sermon. Okay, Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 to 16 is the introduction, and this culminates the introduction where Jesus, at the culmination of his introduction, says to us, the church, to all of his disciples, he says, "You are salt, you are light." That ends the introduction. Now the rest of the sermon is the body of the sermon or the essay, and he moves from then on after that to talk about all the things, what it looks like to be salt and light. The rest of the sermon, the rest of the teaching, the rest of the essay is really playing off of this idea of salt and light. Now what does it look like to be salt and light? And Jesus says things in that essay, in that sermon. Jesus says things like, when someone strikes you on the cheek, you turn to them the other cheek. This is what it looks like to be salt and to be light. Jesus says to them in the sermon, he says to them, don't just love your neighbor. Anybody can love a person they like. No, you also love your enemy and pray for your enemy. See, Jesus says to them in the sermon, this is what salt and light looks like. If someone forces you to carry a load 1 mile, you take it 2 miles. This is what it means to be salt and to be light, he is saying. See, he says to them, let your yes be your yes and your no be your no. This is what it looks like to be salt and light. He says to them in the sermon, he says to them, take the high road, the narrow road. Everybody's taking the wide road. Everybody's taking the easy way out. You take the hard way. You do the hard, right thing, you see. This is what it looks like to be salt and light. See, everything else in the sermon plays off of these verses. And what he is saying here is that we, and by the way, in those verses, he transitions from second person singular, you, talking about you, blessed are you when you mourn, blessed are you when you're meek, blessed are you. This is second person singular in the scripture text, but then he moves from second person singular to second person plural when he says, you are the light, you are the salt. Now, in English, we don't have a way of distinguishing between first, second person singular and second person plural unless you come from the South, right? In the South, we do, right? We say y'all, right? Which means you all. It's second person plural. It's our way. So if Jesus had been a Southerner, and I know some of you are surprised to find out that he wasn't, but he wasn't. But if Jesus had been a Southerner, here he would have gone from saying, you, blessed are you when men persecute you, blessed are you when you're meek, to saying, blessed are y'all. He would be saying, y'all are salt. Y'all are light. You see, so it's not that this is just our identity. It is our identity. It's who we are. But it's also that it's a we. See, we are salt and light. It's about being community, that salt and light is not just me. I'm not the light. I'm not the light of anyone or anything. Maybe Priscilla, my wife, I'm the light. I don't know, but I doubt that even. I'm not the light. I'm not the light of anything. But we, when we come together, when we join our hearts and our spirits and become the church, we together are salt and our light. You see, it's about being in community. And so Jesus is describing here all these characteristics. And when you begin to live this way, you begin to, when that aloha, when the Jesus way begins to work its way and dig its way into your life, then you begin to live in such a way that you begin to stand out. You begin to live in such a way, such a countercultural way, that your light begins to shine. And it's in your essence. It's a part of your identity. It's you, who you are. It's not this idea of being salt and light. He's not saying you ought to be salt and light. This is not something that you're trying to attain to. This is not another rule to follow. This is not another a commandment to obey. This is not another thing to check off your to-do list. This is not something that you are striving for. This is not something that you can say, well, if I just try a little bit harder, maybe I'm going to be light and salt someday. No, Jesus is saying you already are. You are. It is a part of your essence when you're living inside the will of God, when you're living in that sweet spot of your life. See, Jesus says to us, when you're living in the sweet spot, then you are salt of the earth. You are already, you already have it in you. You are already light. Now, Betsy Myers has written a book called Take the Lead, which I have read. I actually read it once a year. To me, it's that good a leadership book. And so if you like leadership books, Betsy Myers, Take the Lead. And in her book, she tells a story of her daughter, Madison, who in kindergarten, who came 5 years old, came home from kindergarten one day and said to her, Mommy, please don't overschedule me. She's in kindergarten. She'd been at school talking to all of her friends and all that they were doing. And she said, and came home and said to her mom, Mommy, please don't overschedule me. I'm tired. I just want to be a kid. I just want to have fun. And so Betsy sat down with her and said, okay, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. She said, you just try different things here and there. We'll try one thing at a time. And when you find something that you like, then we'll focus on that and we'll just take it, you know, a little at a time. So about a year later, they were invited to go to Madison, the little five-year-old. They were invited to go over to Madison's to see Madison's best friend in a dance recital that she was in. And these were girls ages 5 to 18 in this three-hour-long dance recital, tap, ballet, jazz, modern, all the different kinds of dance were in there. And Betsy Myers says that her little daughter, Madison, sat through the entire 3 hours on the edge of her seat, enthralled by what was happening on the stage. And then immediately after it was over, she said, Mommy, this is what I want to do. Can we go sign up right now? And so they did. And about a week later, in preparation for her first dance lesson, she took a beginner's kind of ballet, a combination ballet, jazz, tap. And before her first dance lesson, in preparation for that, they went to the store to get her little dance outfit, right, that you have to have. Because even if you can't dance, you have to look good, right, trying. And so she tried on several little outfits. You know, she's 6 years old. She's trying on these little outfits, and she finally settles on one, a simple black leotard with a little black skirt and the leggings. And she's standing in front of the mirror, and she's looking at herself in her little leotard. And she turns and she says, Mommy, right now I am freaking out with joy. Right? I like that. I am freaking out with joy. And Betsy will tell you that she became enthralled with dancing, that it became almost her whole life, that she every time you saw her around the house, she was practicing her dance moves. And then after her first recital, about a month or two later, after her first little dance recital, she came running up to Betsy afterwards and said, Mommy, I was born to dance. And that if you ask her what she's going to be when she grows up, she will say, without hesitation, a dancer. I'm going to be a dancer. And she knows. But I love that line, Mommy, I'm freaking out with joy, because that's what it feels like when you're living in your sweet spot, when you are doing, absolutely doing what God created you to do, when you're in the midst of the work of it, and it is hard work and hard discipline, but it doesn't feel like hard work. It doesn't feel like discipline because you're living in your sweet spot. See, you're living out the thing that God has already created you to be. He has already put it inside of you. And when you're living out of that, what he has put inside of you, you, then you are going through life freaking out with joy. You understand? Freaking out with joy. Every time I come to church, well, almost every time I come to church, I am freaking out with joy, you understand? Because I'm living out of what God has created me to be. Hey, listen, I'm a pastor, okay? I'm going to be honest with you. Almost every time I come to church. This is what God created us to do. This is what Jesus is talking about here, you see? He's saying, you are salt. You are light. And when you do it, you're living out of your sweet spot, out of who you were created to be. You're freaking out with joy. Now, here's the thing. Salt is an element that was not created for itself. Salt is only useful when it is put on other things. When it is being used, it's an element that was created always for others. It is nothing and good for nothing in and of itself. That's what Jesus means when he says you throw it on the ground and it's trampled on by men. It's useless because it's not being shared. It was created for other things. Same thing with light. He says the same thing. Light, what good is light? If you hide it, put it under a bushel. No, light was created for others, and light is useless if it's not being used to light the house so others can see. This is the we of salt and light, you see. It was created for community, and it was created to be public. It is a public way of living, this salt and light. It was created for always for the other. Both salt and light are community properties. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a great theologian, 1930s, living in Nazi Germany, and was eventually killed for his speaking against and working against the Nazi regime. He was killed in the concentration camp about a few days before the liberation. He was executed for his faith. And something that a lot of people don't know or maybe don't realize is that Bonhoeffer actually studied at Union Seminary in New York City. He was at Union in New York City when the war broke out and all this horrible stuff started to happen, and he didn't have to go back. In fact, many of his friends implored him not to go back but to stay. But he had a community back in Germany. He had a calling. He had a place he knew had to be. So he went back and he spoke against the Nazi regime, and he was killed for it. But one of the things that he said about the church, and I want you to see this. This is what he says. Now, understand his context. Understand his context. He is in a Nazi concentration camp. He says, to flee into invisibility is to deny the call. Any community of Jesus which wants to be invisible is no longer a community that follows him. Remember his context. That's exactly what the church was happening with the church in Nazi Germany. It was becoming invisible. He says, in the face of that, he says, any community of Jesus which wants to be invisible is no longer a community that follows him. We were not called to be invisible. We were called to be salt and light as we live this out. Now, there's some controversy over the Sermon on the Mount on whether or not it was ever meant to be followed even. There are some scholars who say it is so high, so impossible, turn the other cheek, love your enemy. This is stuff, no one can possibly do this, they say. And they try to say, well, you know, Jesus was giving us this impossible ideal so that we would see how sinners we were and how we would always fall short. And it wasn't really even meant to be followed. Dale Allison, a very renowned scholar, in his book, The Sermon on the Mount, the subtitle of his book is Inspiring the Moral Imagination, and that's what he sees in the Sermon on the Mount, something that inspires the moral imagination. And I think certainly it does that. But he says, and I quote, well, I'm going to quote in just a minute. Let me, okay, now I can quote. Fyodor Dostoevsky, in novel, The Brothers Karamazov, the Grand Inquisitor, at one point declares that Jesus judged humanity too highly, for it was created weaker and lower than Christ thought. More recently, the Jewish scholar Joseph Klausner has declared that the Sermon on the Mount presents an extremist morality, one that has not proved possible in practice, one that contains too high an ideal for ordinary mankind, and even too high for the man of more than average moral caliber. In other words, we can never live it. But I disagree. I disagree. For I think that the Sermon on the Mount was meant to be lived out, but it was meant to be lived out as a community. Where I, as a human being, weak and fleshy, I, as a weakened human being, I have a hard time turning the other cheek. I have a hard time loving my enemy. I have a hard time praying for my enemy. I am too weak. I cannot do it alone. But we, as a community, we, as a community, can turn the other cheek. We, together, in the power of Christ, we can love our enemy, and we can pray for our enemy, but we cannot do it alone. We have to do it together, you see. It's a big we. We were meant to live this out as a community. You are to be salt of the earth. So here's what it looks like to be salt of the earth. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's what it looks like, Jesus says in the sermon, to be salt. Here is what it means to be the light of the world. It's Christ in us loving other people. In fact, most scholars agree that the interpretive key to the entire Sermon on the Mount is the radical love ethic of Jesus Christ. And I say radical love ethic of Jesus Christ, where Jesus says, love your enemy, where Jesus says, turn the other cheek, where Jesus says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That is a radical love ethic, and that's the secret to his whole sermon, to interpreting his sermon, where Jesus says, this is the way that people will know that you are my disciples. By the way, your doctrine is all correct? No, that's not what he says. This is the way that people will know that you belong to me, Jesus says. By the way you follow all the rules? No, that's not what he says. This is the way that the world will look in and know that you are really my people. By the way you dress on Sunday morning? No, that's not what he says. You know what he says. This is the way that the world will look in and know that you are truly my followers. By the way you love each other, he says. By the way you treat each other. People will look in and they will see the way that you treat each other, the way that you're there for each other, the way that you have compassion with each other, the way that you forgive each other, the way that you accept each other and bring each other in, no matter what it is that you have done, you love each other. They will, unconditional love, they will look in and they will see this and they will say, I don't know what it is that these people have, but whatever it is, I want it. I want some of this, you see. Jesus says, and that, when you have that, I mean, he says, when you have that, when you start living that out, and I mean really living that out as a community, when you start living that out, you couldn't hide it even if you wanted to, right? You can't hide it. Jesus says, it's like a city set on a hill. How are you going to hide a city? You can't hide a city. No, its light shines and people see it from miles away. You can't hide a city. You can't hide it. Have you ever been in love? I mean, like really madly. I look over the youth group because some of you are in love right now. I know right now you're madly, deeply in love right now with somebody. Have you ever been in love? Some of you are going to have to think pretty far back, but you remember? You remember being so crazy, madly in love that you told everybody about it. You couldn't help but tell people everywhere you went, every conversation. I've met these people before. Oh my gosh, my fiance this and my fiance that and my fiance. I'm tired of hearing about your fiance. You said they're so in love, they can't help but talking about their fiance. You remember that? Remember that feeling? You couldn't hide it. You're so in love. You've got that silly smile on your face all the time. You sing in the shower. So in love, you couldn't hide it even if you wanted to, right? That's what Jesus says. That's what it means to be a Christian, that you love that way. He says it's a city set on a hill. It cannot be hidden. Well, the city can be a scary place. I grew up in Houston, concrete jungles of Houston. And Houston at night, the inner city, I mean, I didn't grow up in the Fifth Ward, but if you've ever been to the Fifth Ward, I don't recommend it at night. It's a scary place. The city can be a scary place at night. Priscilla and I, we were in London and we got lost in London in the bus system, and we kept getting dropped off at the wrong place. We kept getting on buses that took us further away, and we ended up in downtown London at 10:30 at night. and the streets were deserted, and we were walking along, and Priscilla had to hold my hand. I was scared. I was scared. It was very scary. She was saying, "It's okay. It's going to be okay, Alyssa. It's going to be okay." No, it's not. We finally made it back, obviously. But the city can be a scary place, but not so in the first century. Actually, quite the opposite. In the first century, the city was a place of security. The cities, most cities like Jerusalem and Jericho, they were built with these great big massive walls that surrounded them. They did that for a reason. The walls were meant to keep danger out, you see. In the first century, it was the countryside that was the scary place. It was the open country where danger lurked. There were bands of thieves and gangs who would hide in the hills that surrounded Jerusalem, and they would pounce on unsuspecting travelers, beating them up and sometimes killing them and stealing from them. You did not want to be caught outside the city walls when darkness hit in the first century. You wanted to be inside the city walls when darkness fell. That was the safe place. That was the secure place. Have you ever been lost out in the open country on a moonless night? No artificial light? So dark that you put your hand in front of your face and you can't see it? Anybody? Right? Scary. And then out in the distance, you see a flickering light. You think, oh, that if I can just get there, I don't care what that light is. As long as if I can get there, I feel safer, right, with the light. That was the city in the first century. That was the city. So there's a man walking in the first century with his family. They're on their way to the city. And he has his wife and two children. And they've been walking since daybreak, the dusty roads, through the hills. But now it's getting late, and he's misjudged. The children have slowed them down. And he's not sure how much further the city is. And he stares hard at the gate, at the dropping sun, as if his gaze could hold it in its place. And he prays, "Oh, dear God, please do with me what you will. But for the sake of my children, please hold the sun in this place till we can get to the city." He knows that if they are caught in the dark out in the country, that they're in terrible danger. And so he's praying, and he comes to the top of one hill, and he sees on the crest of the next hill, he sees the sun gleaming off of the white stone of the beautiful Jerusalem temple. It's the city set on a hill, and it means salvation for him and his family. And he breathes a sigh of relief, and he says, "Thank you, God. Thank you that we're almost there." You see, that was the city in the first century, and we all need that place. We all need that city, right? We all need that place that no matter how far we have gone, no matter how low we have sunk, no matter what it is we have done, no matter how broken we have become, that place that we can always go back to, and we always know that there we are always welcome, we are always loved, we are always safe, we are always home, you see. We all need that place. For me, it's 720 Crenshaw, Pasadena, Texas. My parents still live there. It's the home that I grew up in, the address where I grew up. They still have my room. They haven't changed a thing. I don't know. They're waiting for me to come back, I guess. I don't know. But it's still there. And every time I go back there to mom and dad's house, every time I go back there, you see, I feel safe. It's the one place I know, 720 Crenshaw, Pasadena, Texas. I know that no matter where I go, no matter how far I've been gone, long I've been gone, no matter how far I have sunk, no matter what terrible thing I've done to wreck my life, here is one place I can always go back there. And I know that I am loved, I am cared for, I am safe, I am home, you understand? I am home, and we all need that place. Everyone in this world, they're broken, and they need that place. And Jesus is saying that we, as the church, we are the city set on a hill. We are that place where people are supposed to be able to come to, and they, no matter where they've gone, no matter how far away they've gone, no matter how low they have sunk, no matter what terrible thing they have done to destroy their lives, that this is the one place they can come to, and they can be safe, and they can be loved, and they can be forgiven, and they can be cared for, and they can be home. You understand? Home. And this is what it looks like to be salt and light. You can't do that by yourself. It's a community that does that. Garrison Keillor is one of my favorite writers, and now I'm showing my age. From something called the Prairie Home Companion. Anybody remember those? Okay, yeah, everybody over 60 raised their hands. Just yeah, Garrison Keillor, but he's really a great writer, great stories. He's a storyteller, and he told a story one time from the Prairie Home Companion about going into the seventh grade. He writes about Lake Wobegon, right, which is this fictitious place that's very much like the place he grew up. And he talks about going into the seventh grade and for the first time moving from a school that was out in the country where he lived to having to be bused into the city, the big city, which is more of a town, Lake Wobegon High School. And Mr. Detman, the Lake Wobegon High School principal, on the first day of school, handed each student from the countryside a slip of paper that had on it the name and address and phone number of their storm home. Every child who came from out in the country to the city was bused in, was assigned a storm home of a family that lived there in town in case there was a blizzard or some kind of terrible storm. Instead of trying to get them back out on the road to their house so far away, they would just go to their storm home there in town. They would stay there and wait out the blizzard. And Garrison Keillor says his storm home was Mr. and Mrs. Kruger. And the Krugers had been his assigned. And he said he liked to think in his imagination that it was no accident that that was his storm home, that the Krugers had actually chosen him. That they had come down to the schoolhouse and kind of secretly looked at all the kids and said, yeah, we'll take that kid, the skinny kid with the glasses. We'll take him. He'll be our storm child. Of course, he says he never actually met the Krugers because that year, that school year, they were all convenient evening and weekend blizzards, no during the school day blizzards, although he prayed for one. And he never actually went to this storm home, the Krugers, but he says that just their being there, just knowing that there was this storm home that he could go to if he wanted to, gave him peace for the day. And he says that Mr. and Mrs. Kruger grew large in his imagination. They lived in a little green cottage by the lake. He passed the house every day. Oftentimes, he wanted to go and knock on the door and let them know, I'm your storm child. Just want you to know. But he dreamed about going and knocking. He imagined what it would have been like if he went up to the door and knocked on the door. Because he said, you know, he writes, I often dreamed of going to see them when things got hard. Blizzards aren't the only storms, you know, and not necessarily the worst thing that can happen to a child. And I often dreamed about going and knocking on the door, and she'd answer the door, Mrs. Kruger, and she'd say, oh, it's you. I knew you'd come someday. I'm so glad to see you. Come on into the kitchen. Sit down. I'll make you some hot chocolate. Would you like an oatmeal cookie, she'd say. Oh, it's awful outside, isn't it? And I'd say, yes. She'd say, it's going to get worse, they say. And I'd say, yes, it probably is. Then she'd say, Carl, come down here. Come see who's in the kitchen. He'd say, is it our storm child? And she'd say, yes, it is. It sure is. It's him in the flesh. You see, this is what it means, salt and light. Being salt and light means that in the power of Christ, you are that storm home, that safe place where people can come and they can find rest for their souls. Jesus, after all, the one that we follow, Jesus, the one that we have pledged our love to, said, come unto me, all ye who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Let's see what that looks like very quickly. We've given you some suggestions we want you to do. We've asked you to do over the next coming months. The first is to write down the names of all of your neighbors so that you know their names. Know their names. The second is to post those names somewhere in your house where you see them daily and can pray for them and pray for those people all around you. Pray for them. And the last thing is to invite them. Whether it's a block party or just a small dinner at your home, invite them into your home and into your life. We suggested a block party. All the extroverts in our church are doing block parties. All the introverts are doing dinner parties. That's okay. That's fine. The idea is invite them into your life and invite them to church, you see, because this is what it means to be The church, salt and light. Jesus says, come unto me, all ye who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And so let's go to him now. We go to Christ as the church to find rest and to find peace for our souls. I want to invite you to partake this morning of the supper with me as we remember Jesus as our Lord and Savior, his sacrifice, his broken body, his poured out blood. Matthew chapter 26, it says, and I'm going to ask those who are going to prepare, who are going to serve, to prepare to serve the supper. He says, while they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks and broke it and gave it to his disciples saying, take and eat, this is my body. Then he took the cup, gave thanks and offered it to them saying, drink from it all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. If you're visiting with us, we invite you, and you're a Christian, we invite you to share in the supper with us now. And now we're going